Lori Houston's News for the Heart is dedicated to helping you give a voice to your own soul. Our hearts have the power to free us from pain and the struggles that keep us from awakening to our true essence. Join Lori now as we delve into our heart and soul to find the path that will open us to the possibilities and lead us to the life we love to live.
And good afternoon. This is News for the Heart. And today I have a wonderful special guest, Barbara Han Clow, who I have had books from you from, well, into the 80s anyways. And I'm very excited to have you on. Now, just a few months ago, I was contacted. I was actually sent a book before I even was contacted to see if I wanted to review it and have you on my show. And it was called Revelations of the Aquarian Age. And when I started looking at it, I noticed that it was part of a trilogy. And of course, the third book isn't out yet, but that one came out in 2017. And your first book, which was called Revelations of the Ruby Crystal, I had to get because there was no way that I was going to do an interview. One, because I love spiritual fiction. And two, I also like to make sure that I read everything so that we do a great interview. So I was very excited to get your first or your second book and then to get the first one and start reading it. And I've read them and just I love the concept. I love, obviously, we don't want to talk about the story as much because we want people to listen to this and go out and buy your trilogy. But I do want to look at some of the themes and some of the, I mean, it certainly was in alignment with a lot of the things that I looked at, some things different. So we'll get into all of that, but I really love these books. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Lori. I'm happy to be here. And thank you so much for taking responsibility for getting the first book. And I would suggest to anybody who gets curious about this trilogy to do that. But, of course, the second book is a standalone. When you write a series like this, each one has to be a standalone. But in the first book, as you know, that's when you really get to know the characters.
Yeah.
And the characters are the basis. You know, they carry the thought form of the whole trilogy itself. And so it's kind of like having a really good friend that you've known really, really well for years. And if you know them really well, then whatever they say to you or talk about with you resonates so much more deeply because you know them as individuals. So that's why I think it's really good to get into the actual characters in a trilogy like this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the other thing that I love about the type of book that you write in certain books. I mean, there's a lot of work out there where, you know, you don't get the rich enjoyment of each character. You get to find out about a character and then all of a sudden they're gone and, you know, you never get to revisit or know what their journey is. So I love that about that. I love to be able to build the character and to see, you know, how they evolve. And I love these books.
Well, thank you. And of course, this one evolved. And of course, before this, I wrote nonfiction.
Yes.
And that's a very different thing. A nonfiction book is me saying something and me researching something. But in this case, I wanted that wonderful nuance and the wonderful delicacy that can come in with fiction. And fiction can be multidimensional in a way that nonfiction never can be. But the most interesting thing about this trilogy to me is that here's how it happened. In May of 2011, I was sitting in my writing room, and all of the characters came to me, and I got out a yellow pad, and I wrote down the date of their birth and their names and their background and family and beliefs and all that. I wrote many pages about these characters. And then I just turned them loose, and I figured that they would be alive from 2011 to 2020, and that they would be living through the great turnover that's happening as the age of Pisces ends and the age of Aquarius is beginning. Mm-hmm. And we're right in the vortex now of that turning point. And I think the trilogy is really helpful to help people understand what's going on around us, because, of course, everything going on around us is just chaotic. I mean, the level of change is so intense that it's very difficult to keep your bearings in the middle of it. And that's one of the purposes of this trilogy, is to kind of hold people's hands while they ride on the roller coaster, so to speak.
And it is a roller coaster, that's for sure. So in your opinion, we're in from 1998 to 2020 is kind of the, I don't know, the beginning of the Age of Aquarius or the entering of the Age of Aquarius. Is that how you're seeing it?
Well, as we move from one age, great age, to another one, and we know a lot about this, we actually have 10,000 years of wisdom about this issue and actually about the changes of five or six ages. This is an old perennial wisdom that's kind of coming back at this point. And so what happens when we move out of an age and then move into the next one is it occurs over around 150 to 300 years. It's a gradual process. But like any level of radical change, there's always a vortex point. And the vortex point astronomically, which has to do with our orientation with the center of the galaxy, is 1998 through about 2030 or 2040. You called that one very well. I think I actually discussed that in one of my other books, but I can't remember which one. So we know that during this 30-40-year period, beginning in 1998, that we're being influenced by the center of the galaxy as we move into the Aquarian Age. And so then, as an astrologer, not an astronomer, but as an astrologer, I analyzed all the transits and everything and came to the conclusion that the most intense part of it would be 2011 through 2020. And that conclusion is also partially based on my Mayan calendar research and the fact that the end of the Mayan calendar is 2011-2012. There's a couple of dates for that because of a couple of researchers. And the idea of the end of the Mayan calendar is that we'd be thrown into a whole new sense of time and a whole new sense of orientation. And if you go back to 2011-2012, that's exactly what happened. And so one of the characters in the book, Claudia Togliatti, an Italian woman living in Rome, she's an expert on the Mayan calendar. And so some of the characters in the book are actually experts in fields of information that we need to comprehend right now in order to cope with this level of change.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah. And any of the other characters, like, is there anyone that... You know, I got the feeling that you were kind of like Claudia.
Some people think I'm like Claudia and some people think I'm like Sarah Adamson. And she's the one who got her PhD in patristics, the early church. And from an academic, intellectual point of view, I'm actually more like Sarah. Because back in 1983, I graduated from Matthew Fox's Institute of Creation-Centered Spirituality with a master's in theology. And at that point, I wanted to get a PhD in the early church. But I had four children and a job, and I couldn't do it. And so what I did is I did it anyway. So from 1983 until now, I've deeply studied early church history because if we go back to the beginnings of the, in this case, the Catholic Church, Christian Church, that was when we came out of the age of Aries and came into the age of Pisces. So in other words, every 2,100 years, we go through the change into a new age. And one of the things that's confusing for people is it goes backwards. And so from like 2000 BC to like 0 AD is the age of Aries, and then the age of Pisces is around 0 AD up until now, and now we're moving into Aquarius, and that's very confusing for people, and I have absolutely no explanation for it. It's just the way it works. But what happens is that when we move into the new age, then the issues of the age that we've been in for a long time come to a level of completion. And so in order to understand the age of Pisces the last 2,000 years, I really felt I needed a really profound understanding of the beginning of the age of Pisces and the the development of the religions of Abraham. There's three main religions in the world that come from Abraham, the great father God, and one is Judaism, one is Christianity, and one is Islam. And so whenever we talk about religions of the age of Pisces, in my case, I'm going after the issues in those three religions. And so what happened was when we went into age of Pisces, fortunately, there was kind of a malformation. Are you okay there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hearing some kind of strange noises on the phone.
I heard that
Might
too.
Be my phone. At any rate, are you hearing that?
I'm hearing okay, it, just, but it's not
just,
me.
Just ignore it. It could yeah, be exactly. somebody trying to break in here.
Yeah.
But the age of Aries from like 2000 BC to 0 AD was the age of warfare, the age of organized warfare. There's no evidence on this planet before 2000 BC for armies and organized warfare. People, of course, robbed camps and hit each other over the head and did all kinds of violent things because people do that. But the Age of Aries really was the age of organized warfare. And so what happened when we went into the Age of Pisces and Christianity occurred, what happened was, unfortunately, the Age of Aries, the issue of organized warfare, became wars for God. And so now we've had 2,000 years of people fighting wars for God, which has been very frustrating, debilitating, and difficult and painful. And that's really what we're coming out of. And so the issue that we're attempting to solve at this point is the resolution of really 4,000 years of history. And that's why it's so intense.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big one. Now,
yeah.
I also have to say that your books are a little juicy.
Yeah.
Which is great, because then we get into the topics of, you know, sacred sexuality.
Right.
Which I adore and think is probably, you know, one of the most important things that we could connect with as humans. But we also get into a little bit of the energy of fallen angels and, you know, maybe the problems with Catholicism, but not necessarily all of Christianity, but certainly Catholicism. It's an interesting phenomenon, and I find it fascinating how you saw a connection that I would have never seen, which is, you know, the pure energy of children.
Well, first of all, regarding what I just said a minute ago, the resolution for the warfare, of course, is creativity and sexuality. And so the reason one of the reasons my books are so juicy is that I really think that the resolution of a lot of the problems for human beings are very, very sexual and very creative. So that's just why that's a basic theme. And then as far as Catholicism is concerned and the fallen angels, this is actually a kind of shadow energy that Christianity has been dealing with that actually goes back, as far as I can tell, around 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. And so in some of my other works, did you read Catastrophobia?
I didn't, no.
Remember reading that? Yeah. Well, that one covers the last 12,000 years of human consciousness. And one of the things that happened on our planet is that we experienced a very, very big solar system cataclysm right around 11,500 to 12,000 years ago. And it's known in mythology, it's known as the fall of Atlantis, or it's the point when we leave the Garden of Eden. It's very deep in all of the theology and mythology that all of us live with. And so what happened when that cataclysm occurred is at that point, evil started to come into our planetary field. And one of the things that we've been dealing with now for like 11, 12,000 years is this issue of how evil affects human consciousness and affects our species. And in that sense, we're kind of a post-traumatic species in a way, and as far as I'm concerned, we're waking up at this point. But when we wake up, from this trauma and from some of these past issues, one of the things that happens is that people start penetrating secrecy and they start penetrating the darkness. And we can see that, for instance, the background of Revelations of the Ruby Crystal is priestly sexual abuse in the Catholic Church specifically. Of course, it's an issue everywhere with athletics, and it's just all over the place on the planet. But what I wanted to do, Lori, was to really get deeply into those secrecy veils, because as the light's coming in and as we're waking up, people are beginning to see what's actually been happening to them. And so that's one of the reasons that it's a backdrop issue in Ruby Crystal, because it's like a shadow of organized religion, the issue of priestly sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. So that's the reason that some of those background subjects have been selected. And then as far as the characters are concerned, it's what they experience. One of the things that's going on with the characters all the way through all three books is individual characters are dealing with different levels of abuse.
Right. And as you say, and as you clearly look at in both books, I mean, we need to be able to deal with this because we have been pushing it down and just, not dealing, putting it in the, it's in the collective unconscious. It's part of our own psyche, and we're just not dealing with it. We don't like to deal with things that make us uncomfortable. We push them down, we repress them, and now they're coming up. And this is part of, I think, what you're also talking about, moving into the Aquarian age. We really need to start dealing with these. Or, as you also mentioned, some of the people are, they're dying off. They're getting cancer. A lot of people lately been getting cancer. And I think that, as you mentioned in, I think the second one, that, that's part of the problem with what we're doing. Mm-hmm, and we're not ready.
Yeah, yeah. And there's no stop. What's fascinating about things at this point is there's no stopping it now. Once something gets going far enough, for the best example I can think of is the trial that we were able to watch on television of the young female athletes who were abused by that doctor. And I just thought it was incredible that the judge, the female judge, set up that whole trial so that those girls one by one would tell their story while he was sitting there. And I don't, by the way, I rarely watch television. I watch it for 15 minutes a day with the news in order to see what the latest program is being put out by the global elite. So for me to watch anything like that is really unusual. But what I discovered watching that doctor in the courtroom and then the girls testifying is I got a palpable sense of the actual fact that people are in another dimension when they're experiencing abuse and when they're experiencing this kind of trauma. Now, in my system, our dimension is the third dimension, which is linear space and time. And so you and I are talking on the phone in the third dimension. But then the dimension just beyond this is the collective archetypal realm that contains all the thoughts and feelings and energies of all the people on the planet. And so what goes on in that dimension functions differently. And because it's not physical the way 3D is, because it's more emotional and intuitive, what happens for people is they have a really hard time grasping what's happening to them in that dimension. They have a hard time remembering it. They have a hard time believing that it was real or that it is real. And so in that trial, I could actually see with those girls, like, speaking their truth and that guy sitting there squirming, I could feel this energy operating where the girls and the guy weren't really totally clear about what had happened or what was happening. Hmm. And so the reason this explosion of truth is so powerful, and the Me Too movement, for example, is once one woman says, hey, this is what he did to me, there's a bunch of other women who couldn't be sure, like, was that real or was it me or did I do something? All these things happen with guilt and confusion. And what happens is the clarity comes through and people are able to say, that's what that person did to me. And that's the beginning of the healing. And in my opinion, I've been watching this for many, many years because I was abused as a really small child. And I've written about it years and years ago. And I've been watching this gradual awakening building, and there's no stopping it now. The truth is really out. And then with the truth coming forth, that's when we're able to examine how this thing functions. And so one of the key background themes in the whole trilogy is how does evil get into our world? How does it function? How does it affect us? And most importantly, what can we do about it?
Right. And obviously that's a huge and important spiritual lesson for all of us to understand and to work through and to get a higher understanding of, because we, the more we feed into the fear, the more we're feeding into the evil that's there. The more we move up into our hearts and to, you know, to really open up and expand and express ourselves truthfully and authentically and, you know, from a love space instead of a fear space, that's, you know, that's when the changes can assist us. But, you know, it's a big step that a lot of people just aren't prepared for.
Yeah, and as usual, you know from my work, I'm one of those people who takes big steps early. So often I'm way ahead of where I need to be. And so the question for me as a writer, having I made this decision, I'm going to track things from 2011 to 2020, and I'm going to work on how evil gets into our world, how it affects us, and how can we change that dynamic. And, of course, in my case, I believe it's actually coming from 10,000 years ago. It's a deep, deep issue. And so I created Armando, and I'm sure you noticed Armando, mm-hmm. Armando the painter. And one of the really fun things about Armando is Armando was going to be the character who was going to be the wounded one who had been abused as a child. And we won't talk too much about the plot. But the issue was, what happened to Armando and how has it affected his life and how is it changing him? And so when it came time to create Armando as in the first book, because all the characters needed to come together then, the question was, you know, how far am I going to go? Because to tell you the truth, some of the subject matter that I'm discussing is really quite unpleasant, and I'm not the kind of person who enjoys unpleasant things, but the time does come to deal with it on that level. So I talked about it with my daughter, Liz, and Liz is the one who did these wonderful illustrations for the first two books, and she'll be doing the third one. Mm-hmm. And Liz is a Scorpio. So Liz listened to me talking about Armando, and she said, I'll tell you what, Mom, what you got to do is you got to make him really bad. And that was hard for me to do, to tell you the truth. But she said, you have to go into the full bore darkness with this character before it's going to be possible to see how this whole thing works. And that turned out to be a great idea on her part and very prophetic.
Yeah. Yeah. And powerful. I mean, it's a powerful journey that both book one and book two are exploring. I can't wait to see what happens in book three. But I mean, the healing and the amount of work that's been happening in, you know, especially book two, I mean, it's very profound. It's definitely, we can definitely learn from each of the characters in there as to where we can, you know, where we can move. I mean, there's from meditation to channeling to, I mean, it's amazing. And, you know, the one doctor that you have, I mean, he is a psychiatrist, but he uses, you know, what he uses and the depth that he can move into people's psyches and, you know, get into past lives and all the different areas of it. I mean, it's like, oh, I would really love to have somebody like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, all the characters. You know, it's funny, this is what you're talking about is Lorenzo Giannini. And Lorenzo Giannini is a very famous analyst in Rome. And by the way, a Jungian analyst in his case. And by the way, all of these characters are inspired by real people that I knew in Europe. But of course, I'm not going to reveal who they are, of course. And so the interesting thing about Lorenzo is, I'm sure you noticed in the second book. Now here's where Lorenzo came from. And this is kind of a funny story. As I told you, back in May of 2011, all the characters came in and I wrote down their descriptions. All of them came in except Lorenzo. So he wasn't there. So then in the middle of writing Revelations of the Ruby Crystal, I had a really amazing experience. This is the kind of experience that authors live for, to tell you the truth, because what I do is from one point of view, pure drudgery. It's really hard work. And so I was writing Ruby Crystal, and I came up against a wall. I hit a wall with Armando, the character who's dealing with such dark sexuality, and I just didn't know where he was going to go. And I was sitting in my office, and Lorenzo Giannini appeared, and he said, well, I'd like you to know that I've been analyzing Armando for 10 years, and maybe I can help. Isn't that amazing? So he showed up, and as you can see in Ruby Crystal, we see Armando going through analysis and depth work and all that. But what's happening with Lorenzo, now Lorenzo, of course, is a key character in Revelations of the Aquarian Age, as you just mentioned. And now I'm writing the third book. I'm right in the middle of it now, and it won't be out till about 2020, so it's going to be a wait. States. And I hope that people are going to be reading these first two books before it comes. And what's happening with Lorenzo, as you can imagine, is that all of the most fascinating characters are gradually getting involved with him. In the third book, he's like a kingpin, almost like a master, you know, like a symphony conductor in a sense, because nice. Gradually, with the type of high energy that the third book is dealing with, people start to need to get into their past lives. They start to need to work with crystals. There's all kinds of advanced healing techniques that they develop because they have to. And I think, Lori, I think we're all going to have to. In other words, I think we're going to be called to deal with things on a high level like that so that we don't get just like ground up in all this chaos that's going on around us.
Yeah. I agree. I think it is that important time. Like it is the time where, and you also mentioned that as we move into the age of Aquarian, that it's really about self-truth. It's not about having to go to the religions to find, you know, our inner being. We need to find that ourselves. But because we're in the middle of both of the two, we kind of have to do it both ways.
Yeah, that's right. And the religions, like, by the way, I think one of the things about the change of the ages, and up until around 0 AD, there were different religious groups that actually taught people about the age changes. And Lorenzo gets after that a little bit, because if you don't understand the process, it makes it a lot harder to go through it. And so as far as the the movement into Aquarius is concerned, there's actually characters who are actually talking about how the whole thing actually functions. And once you start to understand how it functions, it's actually easier to work with it. And so one of the things that's important to realize is that I'm not saying, and I don't think anybody's saying, that the institutions that we have in our lives are just going to disappear, such as the Catholic Church. I don't believe that's going to happen. But I think what I can say is that all of the major institutions in our world, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, or whatever, they're going to have to transform. They're going to have to change into another mode so that what the people need can be, so that they can, you know, serve the people. And so regarding religion, it's not so much about not being in a church. It's more that the church needs to allow you to find the divine, and it needs to allow you to find God. And it shouldn't be an institution that tells people you have to do this, this, and this, and this, or else you can't go to heaven. That's just got to go.
Yeah.
People are not listening to that anymore. And yet you can imagine, I can imagine, a church that would actually, and we do have Aquarian age level churches that do serve people's need to find revelation and divine consciousness within a group of people, within an organization.
Definitely. And I thought it was interesting. I mean, when you look at the different religions, I mean, you definitely believe, and I think that it's true, especially when we look at the one God that Judaism has followed, or I don't know necessarily that they've followed, but is definitely part of the older Bible, the God of fear. And I mean, it's definitely, and you brought it up that it wasn't even the age of Pisces, that it was the age of Aries that Judaism was created. And then the age of Pisces, they needed to have, you know, although we were supposed to kind of go through a beautiful place where we could get rid of that, we just didn't quite make it.
Yeah, and then, of course, Sarah, in the novel, Sarah Adamson, who then becomes Sarah Appel, she marries, she's the one who got the degree in early church history that I wanted to get. Mm. And what she does is she's back there 2,000 years ago trying to figure out how the whole thing misfired as far as the Catholic Church is concerned. Because in her experience, what's happening for her is Christ is just not in the church. And she has a very deep relationship with Christ, and I do also. And she wasn't finding him in the church, and so that became a crisis for her because she was a Boston Catholic from a Boston Catholic family. And then, of course, the priestly sexual abuse thing blew up in 2002 in the Boston Archdiocese. That was the big revelation that started this whole thing. And so for Sarah, she is trying to figure out, like, well, what happened? And she does her PhD on Marcion, who was a Christian theologian and a bishop back around 60 A.D. to about 40 A.D., 144 A.D. And Marcion's church during that period of time and afterwards was much, much bigger than the Christian church. He's a major, major theological figure and Christian bishop, but he has been completely written out of all of the Christian records. And Marcion's basic belief 2,000 years ago was that Christianity should not attach its own scriptures to the Hebrew Bible. And this was, and by the way, the Hebrew Bible, people call it the Old Testament, but I think it's better to call it the Hebrew Bible, because that's what it is, because it's the Bible of the Jewish people. And it wasn't that Marcion thought there was anything wrong with the Hebrew Bible. He just believed that the Hebrew God was not the same as the Christian God. And Marcion taught that the Jewish God was the God, a God of law and judgment, and then the Christian God was that Jesus talked about, was the God of love and compassion. And so it wasn't a judgment about one or the other. We need both. But it's just that he believed that Christianity should not attach itself to the old scriptures and the old God, and it should move into its own form. And I think that's true. And I think there are movements in the church where that's actually happening, even though people don't even know anything about Marcion. For example, one big movement in the church is the revelation of Mary Magdalene as the bride of Christ. And this brings up the issue of Jesus being a loving, compassionate man and not a celibate male, which is a huge issue. I mean, when you think of the sense of identity of Catholics and Christians, when they relate to a Jesus who was married and was even a family man, it's a huge transformation. And I think it's through that awareness of that Jesus was married. I think that's one of the big shifts that's going on within Christianity. So, of course, the characters are having a whole lot of fun with that one.
Well, yes, and it's a big issue.
I mean, it is a big issue. Sacred yeah. sexuality versus celibacy.
Right.
You know, and then what do we get from celibacy but the abuse of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of children?
Right.
And if we're going to pick the most evil thing you can think of, abusing children, that's at the top of the list.
Yeah, and raping women. And, I mean, yeah. it's because we have repressed sexuality, because it's taught everywhere. I mean, that has been the downfall. I mean, we're not meant to be repressed. The repression creates more fears, and the fears are what is allowing the evil to... you know, to be there within all of, you know, within all of relationships. I mean, it's hard to bring the two into some sort of balance when, you know, we're dealing with a really perverse sense of sexuality that is not helping anybody.
Yeah. And it's hard to be a woman and a wife and a mother when you're in the middle of a religion which is based on a celibate male who came from a virgin mother, you know, and so on and so forth. It doesn't work. And what's really happening at this point, the reason for all of the chaos, is it doesn't work. And enough people know that it doesn't work. And yet, of course, if we bring through the issue of the true identity of Jesus, and there's another character in the book, Simon Appel, who's a New York Times reporter, who's doing a lot of work on the discovery of the Jesus family tomb in Jerusalem. And by the way, Laurie, all of the background information in this novel, the case histories of priestly sexual abuse, the research on the tomb in Jerusalem, all this stuff is totally factual. Wow. In other words, it's accurate and factual. And yet the characters within it, what I'm interested in isn't the facts, although we need them in order to understand what these characters are thinking about, but it's the response of the characters to the various issues that are coming through that are the real subtle beauty of this trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yes. And, I mean, do you want to talk about the characters and what role each of them play? Is that I mean, you've brought up
Oh, that's okay. We don't have to talk about how it's an interesting thing where I didn't plot so far, by the way. I just turned the characters loose and let them do what they're going to do. But we don't want to give the plot away, but it's not a problem at all to talk about who those characters are. In fact, the more people, you know, like one of the things I did, obviously, is I selected really interesting characters. Yeah. When I had the choice between a Jewish reporter from New York City working for the New York Times or somebody who was running a car factory, I chose the Jewish reporter. You know, so the characters are coming from a wide background and possibly more importantly, two generations. We have a group of characters who are in their 60s and 70s who are very mature and wise and developed. And then we have a whole younger group of characters who are in their, basically in their 30s, who are responding to the times and responding to the energy that we're dealing with. And then because they're all pretty bright and they're connected in many cases through family connections, then we get to hear them talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. Okay, so let's look at some of the other things that the books bring up. You talk about some of the groups, which, you know, they're secret groups like the Mayan, the 13 Crystal Skulls, and the Templars. I mean, very different, but in some ways they sort of were holding similar values, similar truths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Templars all kind of had to divide out their truths so that not
yeah
just...
and like the Templars are in here and Mayan Crystal Skull, different esoteric groups are mm-hmm. especially with the older characters, they've mm-hmm. become quite involved in things like that. And then when it comes to treating subject matter like that, that's a part of the book, that part of the trilogy is actually revelatory and psychic. Mm. Like I can't give you a factual analysis of the Templars the way I can of the scientific research on the Jesus family tomb in Jerusalem. So there's this layer of absolute factual accuracy that everybody's dealing with. And then what they're experiencing as they think about the changes that are going on, what they're experiencing is they're experiencing different levels of revelation. And so, like all of us who are spiritual seekers, we all have our own little doorways and schools that we use in order to figure things out, if you know what I mean. Like I work with a crystal skull, and a Mayan crystal skull, and I have for many, many years. And it really seemed to be kind of a shame not to finally just put that information in print. And yet I couldn't do that in nonfiction work. You see what I mean? In other words, I'm picking up those threads that are intuitive and psychic. And in my case, I'm also part Cherokee. And have been involved for many, many years with working with crystals because Cherokee really loved to work with crystals. And so these books are loaded with information about how to work with crystals because crystals really work. Right. And crystals are a tool for getting in touch with very high dimensions. They're a tool for healing. They're a tool for psychic insight. And so Cassara, for example, the ruby crystal is a ring that she wears that was given to her for an engagement ring. And the ring itself made Sarah psychic. She wasn't psychic until Simon gave her that ring.
Mm-hmm.
And then she becomes psychic. But this, you know, is a level of creative writing and creative expression that has not been particularly present in fiction and in novels, and yet now I think it's time.
Right.
Because with people, you know, waking up to these psychic levels, it'll get to the point where nobody will be interested in reading a book that's just about shooting guns and crashing cars.
God, I hope
so. You know, they're going to want to know about the real stuff, you know, and not just this silly movie that goes on every day.
Right.
So there's kind of three levels in here. There's the psychology of the characters, and then there's this psychic input. And my best friend lives in New York City, and she's a really, really intellectual person, totally intellectual. She's been my best friend for 55 years. And even she, her name's Hope, even Hope enjoyed the psychic material.
Hmm.
And I've known her all these years, and I know that she wouldn't have many years ago. So I think we're all going through a greater level of comfort with that type of revelation. And so I'm having a blast putting it out there.
Well, it's good. I love that. Like that's what I love about, you know, the books is it's you get to explore the truth, which, you know, some of the stuff, the scientific evidence that you've pulled out, which we don't want to give it all away, because but there's a lot of really, I want to say juicy, but not in the same way that juicy of the books, but just like really things you want to grab onto and say, okay, this is, you know, this is what I've been missing. I mean, I remember in grade 5 getting the New Testament and reading. I was so excited. Like I was so excited. You know, that was the time when they actually gave that, which of course they could no longer do in the public school system. But, you know, so they gave out the New Testament. I came home and I started reading it and I just went, well, this isn't Jesus. This isn't who I know. I mean, I remember so clearly getting so disappointed. It's like, no, no, there's so much missing. And I couldn't even imagine if I had to have read the the Hebrew. Yeah. I mean, I mean,
and what you're talking about is resonation.
Yeah.
Resonating with, and, you know, what people will do with my trilogy is they either resonate with it or they won't.
Sure.
You know, because it functions at a certain level. And yet I felt like I turned 75 this year on Valentine's Day, and I decided, okay, no more keeping anything in the closet. It's just time to put it out there. I mean, if they haven't killed me by now, they're certainly not going to. So, you do. It's really interesting to reach this age where you do, well, some people are just half dead, but you really do come to a level of courage if you keep on, like, participating.
Right. Right, and that's really necessary. And not to be closed off. I mean, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people that, you know, they don't want to hear it because it's too scary for them to think that, that everything they've believed isn't true. And I guess that's kind of what's happened with Sarah in the first book. I mean, she had to really, and definitely her father, I mean, they had to really, that was more the second book, but, you know, they had to really examine what they believed and, you know, what was truth. And I loved how you kind of put Sarah between someone who's a Catholic who, you know, the family would have approved with, who, you know, was so disturbed to Simon, you know, Sir Armand, who, you know, disturbed, and Simon, who, you know, is Jewish. And it was a brilliant way to bring them together. And for her to see for all of us to sort of look at the differences and how they could come together. But it was brilliant because it was a nice way to sort of introduce everything that didn't make it look quite so heavy.
Yeah, and that wasn't plotted. That's just what they did, you know, which is really, really fun. And I think that another thing I'd like to introduce here is that one of the things that comes up in the second book, Aquarian Age, is the issue of going to a therapist and then doing some past life regression work. Because the only way that Lorenzo can really get out, it's actually in the first book, the only way he can penetrate Armando and get someplace with him was to actually put him into a past life context. Mm-hmm. And yet, what's important about that, those elements in the book, is you don't have to believe that. Like we know scientifically at this point that people perceive reality in terms of timelines, and we know for sure that you can hypnotize most people and they'll go back to something that they think of as a past life. That's just a fact. I mean, it's been done with millions of people at this point. It's just a truth. But that doesn't prove it's a past life.
Right.
You know what I mean? In other words, it proves that you can go back into that timeline, and people do it all the time by reading historical novels, after all, or seeing movies or whatever. So I'm not really invested in whether something is whether you can prove it or not.
Right.
I'm just comfortable just letting it happen and just putting it out there. And Lorenzo worked with Armando for 10 years before he regressed him into a past life. Right. He just did Jungian analysis with him for 10 years and helped him. But he wasn't getting anywhere, and so then finally he just got so pissed off, he regressed him into a past life, and everything changed.
Right.
And that type of stuff happens all the time. Psychiatrists who don't believe in it find that their clients do it anyway.
Right.
It happens all the time.
Yep.
So it's really fun to play around with those things that are actually true, but you can't prove. But I don't care whether you can prove something or not.
Right.
And so if you resonate with the book, you're resonating with it because it's a field of information that you're comfortable with.
Right.
You know, and I would hope that the day would come when somebody who didn't ever even think about a past life or something like that would be comfortable reading those stories of what goes on in therapy.
Right.
And those are really fun to write, by the way. And there's more of it. And it's really fun to write up therapeutic sessions. And where that's coming from, as far as I'm concerned, is that I wrote a book called The Mind Chronicles Trilogy, which came out in the 80s and 90s, and now it's in one book. Okay. And I did 100 sessions under hypnosis into my past lives.
Wow.
And so I have really done deep research on this. I still don't believe that you can prove that those are my past lives, and I don't care. But I could definitely I found I could time travel way back. It goes back as far as 100,000 years ago.
Wow.
You can do that.
Wow.
And boy, is there a lot of information. Whoa.
yeah. And that's the thing. Like, we don't know if it's a past life or whether we're just connecting in with the, you know, the fourth dimension, right? I mean, that's a possibility. It just, it doesn't matter. If it helps us,
yeah.
That's what the key is.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you're tuning, when you do that, you're tuning into even higher dimensions.
Sure.
What goes on in my system, I'm working with 9 dimensions of consciousness. And you, when you're doing past life work, you're actually getting into those really high dimensions as well as the fourth dimension.
Right.
You can really go places with that type of therapy.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So now one thing that I don't know if you want to explore it, but Atlantis, you have a very different concept of what Atlantis is or was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The prevailing belief is that Atlantis was technological.
Right.
And after time traveling over tens of thousands of years, as well as visiting sacred sites and everything, it wasn't technology that's anything like the kind of technology that we have today. And so one of the problems with this idea of Atlantis being a technological civilization, and then supposedly what happened is people blew up basically the island and sunk it because of using technology in a negative way. But I've never found any actual proof for that. And in all of my research, although Atlantis for me was a real civilization. And so my problem with it is that when people get into that mindset, then if you look at the modern world, then they're going to believe that human use of burning carbon in the air is destroying the planet. In other words, we've got to be really careful here, because one of the things that's going on in this planet right now is a cyclical change that's going into another level of reality and a level of consciousness. And to blame humans, now first of all, if too many people burn too much carbon in the air, they ruin the atmosphere. I grew up in Michigan where they ruined the atmosphere with car manufacturing. I'm not saying that I'm excusing overusing the resources of the planet in this way. But there's an issue when you start blaming people. Mm. And like, for example, you force people to buy new light bulbs because if they don't, they're doing something wrong to the environment. You kind of see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so in the trilogy, I really go after the issue of what Atlantis actually was. And in the third book, that's going to be very, very prominent. But I had to work through some of the things that I think are false beliefs about Atlantis. And so that's why that's covered with Armando and his father. What happens is Armando's father, Pietro, is a great, wonderful teacher, just the kind of father that all of us would like mm-hmm. to have. And so there are these wonderful discussions going on between Armando and Pietro as Pietro teaches him about the ancient times. And that they're going to go back to 25,000 years ago.
Wow.
In the third book.
Cool.
They're moving back and back and back, which is really fun.
Very.
Yeah.
Now, is it Deneb, the pole star? Want to talk
Deneb
about that?
Or Deneb, you can say either one, yeah.
Okay. Want to talk about that? Because that's fascinating, too.
Well, also, this brings up the issue of, like, what about this information that's in this book? So I went after, in this case, the characters are reading Andrew Collins, who's one of my favorite writers. And Andrew Collins, at this point, he's a British writer, is doing a tremendous amount of research on Deneb as being a cause of evolution in our galaxy and on our planet. And I don't want to reveal too much more about that because people will read about it in the book, and then they're also probably going to go right out and buy Andrew Collins. And so one of the things that I had to do was, okay, here it is. It's 2011. And in my belief, in 9 or 10 years, we're going to go through this total changeover. So my problem was, which data banks do I select that are going to give people the most information about why this change is occurring? And so there are certain people that I picked out, like Andrew Collins. And then what happens in order to give him proper credit is one of the characters in the book gets a hold of his book and mentions the name of the book, if you see what I mean. I never want to use someone else's data, and I never do. And so those background books in the trilogy are my choice of major sources of new information that I think we need at this time.
Yeah.
Another one is the Templar, William F. Mann, and his issue of the Templars and Mary Magdalene. There's a whole data bank in the book. And what I want people to do is go buy his book. I'm just touching on it so that people can see, like, boy, head over in this direction and you'll get something to think about.
Right, which is great. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
You're in the know of all of these very fascinating and interesting areas. Do we want to talk about Mary as a priestess or the bee or possibly Isis?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's coming through, and I'm not going to reveal too much of it again, but there's an issue of who was Mary Magdalene.
Right.
And all the evidence points toward her being a priestess of Artemis, which was a very, very high priestly position back around 2,000 years ago, and that Jesus was chosen as her partner. And there's a lot of reason to think this is true, and so what I did is I just explored it. But again, it comes through the characters. And this brings up a really interesting point, Lori, about writing fiction. Okay, now, when I get into my space, and I tune in because I'm going to be writing for like 3 hours in the morning, which is what I do. I write 3 hours about 4 days a week. That's the best I can get. And so when I tune in, I go into a, like a completely different realm. And I don't really know why I go where I go or why what comes through. I just let it fly. Then I have the chance, after that's happened, a few months later, maybe a year or two later, something will happen out there in the real world that tells me that I was on track. And I watch for that stuff because it's kind of like trying to keep the phonograph on the record. I'm really trying to stay in that groove really accurately. So on the first book, Revelations of the Ruby Crystal, I had written about 2/3 of the book when Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, stepped down and Francis came in.
Right.
And I said to myself, I've got a book, because I could see by what was happening in reality. Well, the thing that comes through regarding the outside world in relationship to Revelation of the Aquarian Age is really fascinating. The book cover has a painting in the Uffizi Gallery on the cover of the book, because the central theme in the book is a painting that Armando paints. And what Armando does is Armando brought through this totally incredible painting of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And I don't have a illustration of the painting because I don't want to rob somebody else's imagination. But the description of this painting is very clear, and it's a painting of Jesus basically ascending and Mary trying to hold him down on the planet. And so then, about 4 or 5 months ago, did you notice the release of the information of Salvator Mundi? Now, Salvator Mundi is a painting by Leonardo of Jesus, and Salvator Mundi means the savior of the world. And the way that whole revelation of the painting came through in our world was exactly the same as what happened in the Aquarian Age. So then I know that that central archetype of that painting affecting people in the current now is actually a reflection of something that's actually going on. I mean, I would give anything to see that painting. Mm. Have you seen pictures of it?
No, which one?
It's a picture of Jesus and just radiating light. And the reason it came through to us was they finally verified that it was painted by Leonardo only a few months ago.
Wow.
And the painting is just incredible. I mean, it's like a total breakthrough into our reality of the energy of Christ. And that's exactly what happens in Revelations of the Aquarian Age. You know, that Christ energy breaks through art and comes to us. And so when I see something like that, I know I'm on track.
Right.
And I'm
I'm looking at it now.
See what I mean? So all I'm trying to do now is stay on track in the third book. Well, can you imagine writing about this period of time? For example, Trump has to be a major character in the third book.
Sure.
And like, what do you do with him? You know? I mean, this is one of the most difficult things that I've ever taken on.
Yeah.
But if I stay, you know what? If I stay on track, it's just like walking down the path on the side of a mountain. I'll make it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, like I said, I'm very excited to hear or to read your your third book. I'm sad that it's going to take another 2 years, but I totally understand because it has a lot of information. I mean, these books, I don't know how long they took. So you started writing them in 2011?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're big books. They're, you know, full of a lot of information, which is just fascinating. Are there any other topics that we didn't really talk about? I'm kind of feeling we're coming to a close. So if there's anything you
want to... The only thing I'd like to say is, okay, I wrote nonfiction, from 1976 through 2012. And so I have a whole body of readers out there who have loved different books, and you're one of them. Mm. And then guess what happened when I switched to fiction? A lot of people have just abandoned ship, thinking, oh it's just fiction. And they're really missing something, because all of the level of knowledge and information that has come through my other books is coming through in these books, and I think they're more fun.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if fiction's fun because you can have an adventure with it. You can go on a journey with fiction. It isn't studying and being in school.
Right.
And I think what's happening with people right now, we're having this huge breakthrough of all this information. So much knowledge is coming through at this point that it's just impossible to keep up with it. And so I think people almost feel like, I've got to get more, I've got to work, I've got to study. But it's time to have fun with this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because from one point of view, most of the information we need is actually already in. It's just a matter of what we're going to do with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it has been a great pleasure. I hope when your new book comes out that we will do another interview on that.
I'd love to.
I really, really enjoyed reading these books. Barbara Han Clow, Revelations of the Ruby Crystal, Revelations of the Aquarian Age. Get these. They're fascinating. They're fun. And they reveal a lot of information. So very excited. Very honored and pleased that you came on the show, Barbara. It's been a pleasure, and I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I did, too. It's really fun.
Thanks. You've been listening to News for the Heart. We've been getting to the heart of what matters with Barbara Han Clow and her newest trilogy of books, and we'll be back next time. Thanks for listening.
Have a question for Lori and want to be on the next News from the Heart show? Drop us a line via instant feedback at bmajor.org. News from the Heart is brought to you by Intuitive Soul and is produced by Major Radio for Clear Channel's iHeartRadio and bmajor.org.